Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As I'm sure everyone is aware, the population of people around the world right now are very concerned about this epidemic, the COVID-19 coronavirus, and the various different countries where the cases of that are arising, in China in particular, but other countries around the world, South Korea and Iran, Italy, and so forth, and the measures being taken to help it to be prevented from spreading and to take care of it and so forth. So seems like it's a good opportunity to consider the impact that that has upon us, how we experience that knowledge or that this situation ourselves, and how the mind relates to that, and how we can most skillfully develop our practice in relationship to this. Picking up on the news and conversations, and to see the general feeling around the planet, then there's naturally the first thing that one is aware of is fear. There's a lot of fear. And so that I feel is probably a good place to start with exploring this whole area, that we feel afraid and intimidated. There's a sense of deep uncertainty, threat, and so just to look at the nature of fear and how that works in our lives, and how it fits into the Buddha's teaching. Now, fear is one of what is called the four agati, or four biases, so that you have raga or passion, desire, dosa, aversion, moha, delusion, and bhaya, fear. So in quite a number of lists and places, those four get mentioned together. The first three, raga, dosa, moha, or lobha, dosa, moha, greed, hatred, delusion, or passion, hatred, delusion, they're known as the three unwholesome roots, the akusala mula. But bhaya, fear, often gets tagged on as well, and that's called an agati, or a bias. So we easily think of fear as something that is bad, or is a corruption, and it's something intrinsically unwholesome. But I feel it's got that sometimes included, sometimes not included character, for a very particular reason. The word agati means a bias. So if the mind is strongly affected by passion, by aversion, by delusion, or by fear, then it won't be seeing things clearly. It will be tend to be in a reactive state. It'll be subject to distorted perceptions, and those are all states which bring suffering along with them of various kinds. But you don't, as far as I know, you don't get fear named as an unwholesome root. It's not like the other three in terms of being something that's intrinsically unwholesome or destructive. So it's good to look at that and why that might be. So fear is a painful state. It's unpleasant. But it's important to recognize that's how it works. Fear is supposed to be unpleasant. It's a painful emotional state that helps you to get away from the place that's where the danger is. That's why fear is unpleasant. If there was danger and we felt great, then we would not get out of the way of the advancing train on the tracks, or we wouldn't get out of the way of the saber-toothed tiger that's about to jump on us. We would not want to get back from the edge of the cliff. We'd feel happier and happier the closer we got to the cliff edge. And it's not the way it works. Those of our ancestors, or those generations who went before us, those who didn't have much fear or had no fear, they're the ones that didn't have many children or any children. They didn't make it because they were damaged. They got ill. They didn't stay away from the dangerous situations. They didn't treat those injuries. They didn't get away from those threatening situations. So we have developed the instinct of fear as a protection. It's unpleasant, but that's how it works. It's supposed to be unpleasant, just like physical pain. That's how we protect the body, is because when you've injured yourself and you have a bruise or a cut, an infection, it's tender. You want to keep things away from it. You want to protect it. You look after it, because if you don't, then the infection will get worse. It won't be able to heal properly, and the infection can spread easily through the body, and that'll kill you. So just like physical pain, it works by being unpleasant. That's its job. It's not a defilement. It's not a problem. It's a protection. So fear is exactly that. It's a psychological state. It's a quality of mood. But it works by being unpleasant. So when we feel fear, then we want to then get away from that place or that situation, that contact that's arousing that fear. So we'll get to a place where we go, oh, we feel comfortable. So that's protecting us. So this is how I think it's important to relate to fear, because we might feel, oh, I'm so anxious, I'm so worried all the time. I wish I never had fear. You know, fear is a terrible thing. I wish I was never afraid of anything. But even though that's understandable, you know, we might feel, I don't want to have this unpleasant mental state. Just like physical pain, we might feel, oh, I never want to feel pain. But if we were numb in that way, or if we didn't have physical pain, then we would very easily succumb to illnesses or injuries, and the body would be heavily compromised, endangered, and great sickness or death would ensue. So similarly, with fear, it's not the nature of fear itself that is intrinsically a problem or a defilement, but it's really how the mind relates to it. So I feel that's a very important thing to understand. Particularly because we're human beings, we remember and we can imagine. So we remember the past, we can look back and recreate images and feelings of the past. We can look into the future, we can create imagined futures. What might happen next week or next month? What's going to happen with the coronavirus next week, next month? What's the news today? How many more cases? How many people have died? Is it spreading? Is it getting worse? Is it leveling out? What's happening? We can imagine the future. We can project. And so this is where I would say a lot of the real dukkha, the suffering around fear and pain, arises. It's through the unskillful use of memory and imagination that the mind creates images of the past, the future, and gets lost in them. And so this is where the stressful quality, the real suffering from fearful states, anxious states, arises. It's the mind's grasping of them, and that grasping is almost always tied up with those feelings of me and mine, I and me and mine. The ahankara, the I am feeling, the mamankara, the mine feeling. That's almost always what happened to me in the past. What was my problem? How things were bad and difficult for me? What happened last week or last year? And what might happen to me next week? Or what's going to happen next year to me? How's my life going to be? So in terms of our practice, I feel fear is a useful thing. So like the precautions that we've instituted here at Amravati, encouraging people to keep clean hands, to cough and to sneeze mindfully, and to not be endangering each other or spreading any infections around unnecessarily. That's based on fear, but it's an appropriate fear. It's useful fear. It's a kind of a wise fear that we want to make sure. We want to be careful. We want to be respectful of the way that nature works, and so that it's a skillful use of that mental state without letting it get beyond the bounds of the present moment and what's appropriate, what's necessary, so that we can use that concern, that care. We can apply it. We can take what steps are necessary, and then let go. Do what you can, and what you can't do, you don't make a problem out of. This is, I feel, the most skillful attitude that we can each of us cultivate with respect to this. With our practice, then, I feel in terms of the meditation, it's very, very helpful to be consciously paying attention to what the mind creates, and so that if it's dwelling on fear and anxiety, what's going to happen in this moment? That is a feeling of anxiety. The mind imagines a possible future, and then absorbs into that possibility. So to see that happening and to name it, to say, here is the mind creating an image of the future. It feels like this. There's this emotional tone to it. There's this tension or this ache in the heart. This is the feeling of fear. It's like this. It feels this way. You're not going to make it sweet or pleasant, but you're going to know in this moment, here is the feeling of fear. This is a feeling of anxiety. This is the mind creating an image of an imagined future, and here is the emotion that goes with it. Ow, it feels like this. So in that moment, it's just that much. It's just that painful emotional feeling. No more, no less. We don't have to get rid of it. We don't have to suppress it. We don't have to believe in it. But if it's known in this moment for what it is, then that there's a quality of real mindfulness and wisdom established in relationship to that. Part of this whole process also is and the presence of such an illness, an epidemic around the world. Part of the considerations around that, as we do regularly, we have these the five subjects for frequent recollection that the teachings encourage us to bring to mind. I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So we have these daily reflections and we can recite the words, and yet when it really comes home to us with a living actuality, like, oh, this brand new disease spreading around the world and infecting people very easily. Also the news that it can infect animals. Also that news that someone has recovered from it and then got it again so that it can recur. You know, these can feel like, you know, I'm of the nature to sicken. Oh, but not that. Oh dear, that's not fair. Or it shouldn't be that way. Or we should... must have an antidote, a vaccine, surely something to stop that happening. That can't be right. So all of that you know, this has got to be stopped, or this can't be happening, or oh dear, not that. These are all very natural, again, self-based instinctual reactions to the actuality of anicca, of uncertainty. And the organic and dependent nature of this life of ours, the very fabric of our physical existence, this physical body, is a staggeringly complicated and intricate system of processes that work in an amazingly efficient and well-integrated way. Even those of us who feel we have illnesses or difficulties and have obstructions or medication we have to take or physical obstacles of one kind or another, even so, it's incredible how complicated the body is, and that any of our bodies work as well as they do is somewhat miraculous. I was just given a copy of Bill Bryson's most recent book, simply called The Body. I think it's the subtitle is A User's Manual or a guidebook for occupants, something like that. And he's a very good writer and makes complex subjects or can convey a lot of information in a very readable and accessible way. And he's always a great champion for when he does his sort of popular history or science or books and those kind of things. He's a great champion for the underdogs or people who worked really hard in some field, whether it was in medicine or science or archaeology or. And they work for years and years, and they had all their data stolen by somebody else, and then the person who stole all the data or and stole their projects then become famous and remembered. Bill Bryson's very good at doing the research and finding out who really did the work, who really made the discoveries, and raising people's names up to be recognized and honored. Anyway, I recommend this as a very readable and interesting book as a different approach to contemplation of the body and its many parts, particularly the extraordinarily intricate and dependent nature of the body, how all the different parts have to work in relationship to each other, and how fragile and how marvelous and complex how well ordered the whole system is. And when you really bring your mind to the body and its workings and all the different organs in this kind of a way, you really look at it and contemplate it, think it through, then the fact of disease becomes far more natural. Well, it's amazing that we don't have more infections, that the whole way that the immunological process, how the body protects itself from invasion is amazing. How it looks after its own fabric is extraordinary. How it determines which are the helpful bacteria and which are the obstructive ones. The whole process is quite marvelous. And the way that nature works is that within the whole field of the living world, the living system, there's a constant, incessant evolution of bacteria and viruses and microscopic creatures and such like that are developing all the time. So it's amazing that these kind of illnesses and epidemics don't happen more often. And it's amazing that our bodies can be resilient enough to protect themselves at all. So reading these kind of things, I feel it's very much in accord with the Buddha's teaching, because I feel that those reflections, I'm of the nature to age, I'm of the nature to sicken, I'm of the nature to die, and so forth, they are helping us to have a realistic perspective, to not take for granted that I should be protected, or I should be healthy, or I should be comfortable, or my eyes and my ears and my digestion should continue to work indefinitely. My legs should be continually able to carry the body around. I should be able to think clearly, should be able to remember things, should be able to use my voice or my other faculties. And as with those reflections that the Buddha offered, when you really look at how the body works, it helps really bring it home that we shouldn't take anything for granted. Yeah, the system is so complex and so fragile. We should be rather grateful that it works as well as it does, and to not be complacent, to not take for granted that it will continue to work. So that is threatening to the ego, that's threatening to the habits of self-view that want to have everything as I like and according to my preferences and my presumptions, what is familiar to me, what I like, to be able to see and hear and move and think and to taste and smell and touch and digest and have energy and clarity in the mind and so forth. But it helps us to recognize, well, enjoy it for today or this moment, because tomorrow it can be gone. So if that is really taken to heart in a skillful way, even though that might challenge the ego and the habits of self-view, there's in that, say, appreciation of the reality of things, then there's a quality of relief. That the Buddha, when he encouraged those reflections, he wasn't trying to make us feel anxious or intimidated or neurotic, paranoid, but rather his intention in encouraging those reflections is to enable us to be realistic and to learn how not to be complacent, not to take things for granted, not to make assumptions. And that's really the different way it points directly at the different way that the mind can, say, appreciate that the fact of nature, that everything is in a state of change, everything is uncertain. The anicca, the truth of anicca, of change, of uncertainty. When uncertainty is appreciated on a basis of ego, of self-view, of sakkayaditti, then change, anicca, is threatening. It's dangerous. I don't want to lose the things that I've got. What's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to the things that are precious to me? I don't want it to change. I want to be sure of how things are going to be. I'm going to make sure that things don't change. I'm going to do everything I can to keep that danger, that threat away. I'm not going to let it happen. This can't happen to me. This can't happen to my people, my things, what's precious to me. And that's natural enough, but not everything that's natural is liberating. So that self-centered perspective, even not just caring for this individual, but in a sense the people that we're related to, our family or our population, and that sense of, no, I can't let this happen. This is us. This is terrible. This can't be allowed. That always brings a sense of threat and danger, and there is dukkha that comes from that, because that is the quality of fear, and fear being attached to. I'm going to lose this. I don't want this to happen. This can't be allowed. This is unbearable. So then, when the mind clings to uncertainty on a basis of self-view, dukkha is always the result. It's a direct path to creating dukkha. Oh, if we follow the Buddha's advice and the advice of our great teachers, Lumpur Samedo, Lumpur Cha, and the teachings of other countless elders over the generations, the encouragement is to deliberately put the attention onto anicca, to develop the anicca sanya, to rather than say, attaching to that uncertainty on a basis of self-view, to let go of self-view, to not let the mind be dominated by those ego-centered habits, but rather to cultivate that quality of realism, seeing things in terms of nature rather than in terms of me and mine. So when the heart appreciates the natural order, like, you know, looking at the body and its workings, how it all fits together, then we and developing that sense of the changing, uncertain, fragile nature of the whole natural system, then rather than that appreciation of uncertainty leading to fear and suffering, you still don't know what's going to happen. There's still a not knowing of what things are going to turn into. But when that quality of nature is appreciated, free of self-view, then the emotional tone is that of wonder, wonderment, the sense of mystery, that there isn't that quality of dukkha, of stressing, of tensing in the heart. There's a not knowing, but that not knowing is mysterious, it's beautiful, there's a quality of wonder rather than that of dread or of suffering associated with that. Oh, speaking in this way, it's important to understand that when we are talking about uncertainty and appreciating it from a view free of self and I and me and mine, that doesn't mean that action isn't taken. So it doesn't mean, okay, so I don't need to wash my hands, or I'm going to happily just live with whatever bugs come and enter this body and just let it all happen. That's a mistaken understanding. That's not what this quality means. Being free of self-view doesn't mean stupid. Doesn't mean being foolish or just attached to a habit or an idea. But it's, you still take action. You follow the way of looking after the body, looking after the living situation, doing the best you can for harm not to be perpetuated, not to be caused and carried on. But those actions, those choices, are guided by mindfulness and wisdom rather than me and my fears, me and my anxieties. It's rather that, the taking of appropriate action is guided by an attentiveness and attunement to the time, the place, the situation. So there's care, there's attention, there's work that's done to help look after the living system and to do the best for suffering to be minimized. But that effort is not based on self-view. It's not me, I have to do this, I should do this, I shouldn't do that, I must, I should. But rather the actions are taken and the work is done that is, all that can be done to help benefit the living system, but without attachment, without self-view, and without confusion. So particularly in that, if we are going to cultivate mindfulness and wisdom, and particularly with issues like this, then it's not uncommon for people to have particular opinions or points of view, or say, well, I think that we shouldn't be doing this, we should be doing that, or that this is totally wrong, we should do it this way, we shouldn't do it that way. And so I would also be cautious of attaching to your own particular viewpoint and feeling like you understand things better than everybody else and everybody else has got it wrong. But with respect to helping to look after things in as skillful way as possible, I would suggest that we pay attention to the information that has been circulated, the people in the community who've been informing themselves. We've been very, very helpfully supported by Dr. Tina Chi and Dr. Rundala Hatutoa, particularly giving us advice and connecting us with the NHS resources and the immediate sort of daily information that's available to help us to set up good standards. So I would encourage people to be getting acquainted, getting to know what those standards are, and being ready not to attach to your own particular opinions, and to get a sense and to follow and see what the community standards are, to follow the community standards and to abide by that for everyone's benefit. That's very, very helpful and also conducive to community harmony. You know, the doctors, the medical people out there are working hard in many places trying to find some kind of a cure or a vaccination or some kind of treatment that will help this. But that hasn't happened yet, to my knowledge, but people are working towards that. So I feel just to do what can be done in the time being to help look after things and to say take care of each other's health is the most important thing. Yeah, on a practical level for us. Yeah, the way that that illnesses are treated and the appropriate thing to do, that does evolve. And one of the interesting things, reading this Bill Bryson book, I'd read this before, but I was reminded of it, was that up until the middle of the 19th century, it was the idea that doctors or surgeons should wash their hands before treating a patient or doing surgery was unheard of. And there was a doctor called Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis came up with this unique idea that it might be a good idea to wash your hands and to have clean equipment and clean clothing to before you did surgery or you helped women to give birth to their babies. He was considered a sort of an extremist nutcase in his time. The idea that what kind of an idiot are you that you should wash your hands? In those days, apparently, if you were a surgeon, it was a kind of badge of office. If you had an apron that was covered in kind of dried blood and goop of many years standing, that was like, okay, this person, this guy really knows his stuff. He's got his sort of, he's been around for a long, long time. His, 25 years of goop has accumulated on his apron there. He really knows his business. So that was like, when you saw the doctor coming to your bedside and this apron was stiff with several generations of dried blood and gunk, oh, okay, this is a really good doctor. He really knows his stuff. I mean, I'm in good hands here. So we're very fortunate that Dr. Semmelweis is probably responsible for saving many more human lives than a large number of other very well respected and admired people, and that. Finally became adopted as a basic standard once they realized that the mortality rate of the babies in the natal unit was much, much reduced. The more children survived and less of the mothers died of childbed fever and infections and such like. But finally, after a couple of decades, people began to pay attention, and now we know it's a good idea for doctors to have clean equipment, wash their hands, and not have their surgical gear covered with dried blood and gunk. So understanding evolves, and people are learning as they go along what is going to be helpful. But I would going back to just taking care of this community, just take this opportunity with a large number of the Sangha gathered here for us to bring attention to the community standards and to do our best to look after each other in being attentive to those standards and to minimize the risk of infection for each other's benefit. The core of the investigation or the purpose of developing the Anicca Sanya is really, I feel, summed up in words of Lumpur Cha, which was a very, very common theme, very regular theme for him. And he would say things like, if you seek for certainty in that which is uncertain, you're bound to suffer. If you seek for security in that which is insecure, you're bound to suffer. You're looking in the wrong place. You're looking for something in a place where it is not. It's like if I've left the keys to the office in my yam, and I'm looking for them in the monk's reception room, I won't find them there because they're not there. I'm looking for my keys in the wrong place. No matter how hard I look in the monk's reception room, I won't find them because they're not there. So, and this is exactly the kind of example Lumpu Chao would give. So, if you're looking for security in a place where it is not, you can work day and night, and you can put a huge amount of time and energy and effort, but you won't find it. If you look for security in that which isn't secure, if you look for certainty in that which can't be certain, then you have to be disappointed. It can't work. So, when we find the mind moving towards wanting to be sure about things, wanting to be sure about our body, or be sure about what how things are going to be in the future, or whether we're going to have this kind of an event, or whether things are going to work out with this particular project or for this person's well-being, we don't know. We can't be sure. So that letting go of looking for certainty where things are uncertain, just noticing that habit of saying, "Oh, I'm trying to be sure about something which can't be sure. I'm trying encouraged or feel at ease about something which can't be certain, can't be fixed." Then that relinquishment is something that it requires moment by moment attention, because those habits are very strong for us. The way that the mind is complacent, it takes things for granted, it assumes it's going to be this way, or I'm going to get that result, or this person always does this, or this is the way it always goes. We should be able to expect that. Say, to see the mind doing that and say, no, it's not a sure thing. We don't know what's on the other side of that door. We don't know what's going to happen next week. We don't know whether that bug's going to arrive. We don't know whether we're going to hold the Lumpur Sumedho open retreat. We want to, we're still planning to, but will it happen? Don't know. Yeah. So that seeing of that outflowing tendency of the mind trying to have something to be predictable, trying to have something sure, to see that and say, no, it's not a sure thing, it's not a sure thing, it's not a sure thing. That's the first part. And then restraining the mind from trying to invest in and find security in that which is unstable, that is, not looking in the wrong place. But then, where can we find security? Where can we find stability? Where is that quality of certainty to be found? You know, is it findable? Is there something that is certain? What is the quality that is reliable? So that when we talk about letting go of that search or that effort or that habit of trying to seek certainty, then if we're just left with self-view and nothing to sort of hang on to, then there's still a lot of dukkha. But in essence, what the main purpose or the purpose and the result of vipassana meditation, insight meditation, is it's establishing certainty where it can be found, where there is a refuge, and this is why we talk of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha as a refuge. That's where there is security. That's where there is stability. That is what is reliable. That's why they're the sarana, the titsarana, the three refuges, or the three jewels. So that when we look at this and consider this in terms of meditation and vipassana meditation in particular, if we say the three jewels are what is reliable or what is certain, it's not just the words Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. They're just conditioned objects. It's just three words, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. They're just sounds. They're just ideas. So it's not just the idea of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. It's not just the words of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. That these are not the refuge, but it's the actual quality that those words are referring to. That is what is the genuine sarana, or the the foundation of stability, of reliability, that which is sure, that which is certain, that which is the ground of reality. It's also interesting how the Buddha's teaching we use the words refuge and jewel as interchangeable. So the image or the symbol of a jewel is something that is beautiful, is something that is stable. I mean, obviously, you know, stones like diamonds and rubies, they're just material elements that are also in a state of change, but it's in terms of symbolism, a jewel is something that is hard, it's durable, it's beautiful, it's valuable, has a symmetry to it. There is, and these are the qualities that the Buddha was evoking or bringing into our attention when speaking about the refuges. These qualities, they're beautiful, they're naturally beautiful, they're naturally valuable, they're naturally reliable. Essentially, when we are developing the practice of vipassana, this is the direct work of strengthening, clarifying that quality of awareness, the mind that knows this moment, that hears this, that knows the sounds of these words, that knows the feelings of the weight of your body on the cushion or the chair, the feeling of the clothing on your skin, the sensations of heat or coolness, sleepiness or clarity, comfort or discomfort. That quality of awareness is, that is the Buddha refuge. That is the awake, aware quality. That is the refuge. And insight meditation is, strengthening, clarifying, is directly pointed towards the clarifying and strengthening of that quality of awareness and enabling that awareness to disentangle, to not be identified or in a state of attachment to the objects. So that which knows sound is not a sound. That which knows sensation is not a sensation. That which knows a thought is not a thought. This quality of awareness is intrinsically unentangled. It's not, identified with the objects of awareness. This is why liberation is possible. This is the foundation of vipassana, of insight meditation. That which knows the five khandhas of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. Is not part of the five khandhas. It knows the five khandhas arising and passing away. It knows body and mind, the aspects of body and mind, the perceptions and thoughts and feelings. It knows them arising and passing away, but it is not them. It's not identified with them. If that quality of awareness, this very knowing ability of this heart of ours, if that was intrinsically part of the five khandhas, liberation from the five khandhas would be impossible. Liberation from birth and death would be impossible. But because this quality of knowing, this awakened awareness, this Buddha refuge, is a quality that is intrinsically transcendent, it's liberated from the five khandhas, that means that if that is clarified, if that, say, that non-identification, non-entanglement is realized, then that in this very moment the heart is awake and is freed. That's the essence of this practice. This is the liberating quality of this practice, so that we are in the moment that the heart disentangles, there is freedom from clinging. In that moment, that Buddha wisdom is clarified. It might just be for a brief time, a few seconds or half a second, just a moment of non-clinging. But in that moment, the mind is awake. It knows feeling, but it is not identified with that feeling. It knows fear, but it's not associated with that fear. It can know heat and coldness, comfort and discomfort. It can know the feelings of the breath and the feelings of happiness or sadness. But it is not entangled with those. It's not identified with those. It's free. It's awake. It's aware. It knows, and it's unburdened by those qualities, whether they're coarse or fine, pleasant or unpleasant, coming from inside or outside, whether it's a thought or a sound or something that we see or smell or taste or touch. Then that quality is it knows them. It's aware of them, but it is not limited by those qualities. That which knows perception isn't limited by perception. That which knows all of the aspects of this person isn't a person. It's not male or female, old or young. It's not a monastic or lay. It's not Buddhist. It's awake. It's aware. It knows. So this is why it's a jewel. This is why it's precious. It's the most valuable and the most reliable of qualities, because the more that the practice is developed, the more it's realized that even if there's agitated or busy or noisy or painful or really exciting or shocking or delightful perceptions, then the more the practice is developed, the more that, yeah, there's that delightfulness, there's that excitement, there's that deliciousness or that disastrous event, but that which knows it is not defined by that, it's not limited by that, it's not burdened by that. It knows it, but and it's attuned to it. It knows the world, but it's not limited by the world. It's not carrying the world around. So this is, say, the other side, or the fulfillment of that development of the anicca sanya. So rather than letting the mind get born into anxiety and fear, getting born into that sort of that tense state, and just trying to get away from it by distracting the mind or numbing the mind or just switching off or putting our attention on something else. That it brings the attention to that, developing the anicca sanya. Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know where things are going to go, and that doesn't have to be a cause of suffering. That doesn't have to be something that is burdensome or painful or difficult. Doesn't mean we become numb or foolish or don't take steps to look after our lives and the lives of others, but. As we take care, as we bring attention to that, the flow of pleasant and painful, neutral experiences, then the heart is awake and open, limitless, responsive. It's not needing any particular outcome in order to be free, in order to be at ease, in order to do what needs to be done. When we think of the three refuges, then I feel it's good to bear this in mind, and that the Dhamma is the fabric of reality, and then that's the refuge of the integrative principle of all things, of the universe, mental, physical, spiritual, that which integrates, that which upholds. That's what Dhamma literally means. It means that which integrates, that which upholds, that which supports. So the Dhamma is the fabric, the substance of reality. And then the Buddha, that quality of knowing, buddhi, the quality of awakened, aware, knowing, that is the function of Dhamma. The activity of Dhamma is to know, to be awake, to be aware. And when that knowing is say active and is, say, actualized in relationship to this life and the experience of the sense world, then what arises is sangha. That's the way knowing, the result of that knowing, that awakened awareness of the world is sangha, which is wholesome, which symbolizes wholesome action, that which is, beneficial, wholesome, liberating, that which is, say, intrinsically in tune with reality and, inclined towards what is noble, what is, of the greatest benefit. This is not to, becoming inflated or thinking of ourselves just because we're wearing a robe and have a shaved head that we are the manifestation of all that's good in the world, but rather as an internal quality. When I describe the inner quality of sangha, it's really that when that quality of awakened awareness is active, then what that that informs the intentions to do good. And I say that refuge in sangha, or the sangha refuge as an inner quality, is that voice in the heart, that in the heart which loves the good. It's called the guna dhamma, or the quality of virtue in the heart, that in the heart which loves the good, that rejoices in unselfishness, that rejoices in harmony, that rejoices in generosity and respectful and compassionate behavior, and that which delights in goodness. That is the sangha jewel. But when we develop the practice in this way, we find certainty, we find reliability. That quality of knowing is always available. Doesn't matter how chaotic the field of perceptions is, what's going on in sound and color and form and shape or feelings of the body. You can be hallucinating, you can have a fever of 105, you can have a broken leg. But that which knows the broken leg is not broken. That which knows the fever isn't feverish. That which knows hallucinations isn't hallucinating. It knows the hallucination, the weird mind state or the weird imagery, but it is not bound by that. It's not born into that. It is not the owner of that. It knows it, but it's not burdened by that. So we find, not as a belief system, we're not saying I'm hanging on to Buddha Dhamma Sangha as another perception just to try and make that a permanent perception. No. The real Buddha refuge is not a perception. It's a quality of the heart that's independent of circumstances, it's independent of external conditions. It's free and reliable, and something that is, there is the potential to know that, to actualize that, to embody that in this very life of ours. And this is why we practice. This is why we live together and spend so much time, on the cushion or on the walking path, bringing attention moment by moment, day by day, to clarify this quality and to know for ourselves that reliability, that this is where certainty can be found. This is where, stability, this is where strength and genuine value and meaning can be found. Not in the sense world, not in the field of thought and perception, emotion, imagination, not even in blissful, concentrated mind states, but only in this quality of awakened awareness, and that is to be discovered, to be realized by each of us. But when we do, when that is actualized, when that is known within the heart, There's a certainty in that. The heart knows, okay, this is always here. This is always available. This is reliable. This can be, ever present. It's not anything that goes away. It can be overlaid by dullness or distraction, but that quality of awareness is always here, right at the very basis of experience. It's the very ground of all experiencing. It can't be lost. It is a foundation. It is a true sadhana, a refuge. So I offer these words for consideration this evening.